It's Friday, October 30th. They've got a whole country to fight over, and yet they're battling over one stretch of highway. We start here.
I love this state, and I love the people of this state.
The presidential campaigns launched their most furious travel schedules yet, intersecting in Tampa, Florida.
If Florida goes blue, it's over.
What travel itineraries can tell you about the last 4 days of the race. You can cut all the political ads you want. If you're President Trump, none of them will sound better than this.
It was the best economic growth we've seen in a quarter ever.
But economists are worried that positive wave could be cresting. What could make the difference? And barely a week after one terror attack in France, another has struck, only bigger.
He said right now, France is pretty much at war.
From cartoons to murders, why authorities are fearful of copycats. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. You remember Nate Silver yesterday saying, by the numbers, Pennsylvania is the single most likely state to put our next president over the top. If it's a Trump re-election, Pennsylvania is probably the one that clinches it for him. If it's a Joe Biden win, Pennsylvania should be key. There's one issue with all that. Pennsylvania is also one of the states where counting votes could take the longest.
The United States Supreme Court says it will not fast-track a new Republican appeal to nullify mail-in ballots received after the election in Pennsylvania. As of right now, mail-in ballots postmarked by Election Day but received up to 3 days after November 3rd would be counted.
Pennsylvania is one of several states that does not necessarily count mail ballots until election night. There's a ton to get through. Polling shows a lot of those mail ballots will be from Democrats, which is why political scientists have said it's possible what you might see is, they're calling it, a red mirage. Voting results coming in from Election Day that look like Trump is dominating, only to be evened out overnight as those mail ballots keep getting counted. So think about how troublesome that could get. Election results are coming in, right? Let's say President Trump has just narrowly pulled off victories in states like Iowa, Arizona, Georgia, North Carolina. Suddenly, the world is going to be looking to Pennsylvania for answers. We already know what that argument could look like.
And hopefully, the few states remaining that want to take a lot of time after November 3rd to count ballots, that won't be allowed by the various courts.
Because once the winner is declared after all the ballots are counted, all the votes are counted, that'll be the end of it. That'll be the end of it.
The only way we can lose, in my opinion, is massive fraud. And that's what...
Now, there are always votes that are tallied after Election Day. There's nothing weird about that. This year, there's going to be more of them. And by law, states have weeks to finalize their results before certifying them. However, an even bigger state should be able to count its votes faster than Pennsylvania. It's a state that's absolutely crucial for President Trump, and it would solve a lot of headaches for Joe Biden if he can win it. That state is Florida.
Hello, Broward County.
I love this state, and I love the people of this state.
And yesterday, for really the first time this cycle, you saw these candidates converge, not just in the same state, the same part of the state at the same time as the final flurry of appearances begins. Let's start the day with ABC's chief national affairs correspondent, Tom Yamas. And Tom, you're from Florida, right? How important is this state to each campaign at this point?
Well, look, it's the biggest battleground state, right? When we look at the big six of the battlegrounds we're looking at, Florida by far has the most electoral votes at 29. It's a state that President Trump won 4 years ago. He won it by more than 110,000 votes. And it's a state that everyone has their eyes on right now because I believe it will set the tone for the night.
Ladies and gentlemen, the heart and soul of this country is at stake right here in Florida. It's up to you. You hold the key. If Florida goes blue, it's over. It's over. Look.
They are processing their early votes there. We do expect to know the winner of Florida on election night. And it's a state where the polls are tightening up.
And based on the numbers that we're getting, we're going to do really well on Tuesday. Tell you.
If you look at the polls, Joe Biden is on top, but the Trump campaign is convinced that they're going to win. They think the polls, like they were wrong 4 years ago in several battleground states, are wrong right now in Florida. And they see hope in some polls, right? They sort of cherry pick the polls they like. And one poll they are cherry picking is the NBC Marist poll, which shows for the second time since September, Joe Biden has a serious problem with Latino votes. Right. Now, if Joe Biden wants to win Florida, he's going to need to win the Latino vote. And he's going to need to win it in a decisive way.
Yeah. Is there a sense that if Joe Biden is losing the Latino vote, I mean, in any case, we've seen President Trump pulling decent numbers with Latinos in Florida. Is there a sense as to why?
So look, the two areas we have to remember are Miami-Dade County, the biggest county, the most number of votes. You have your largest proportion of Latino voters there in Miami-Dade County. I'm from Miami. It is the capital of Latin America. It is an incredible city, and it is so diverse because of all the Latinos that live there.
And what you got to do is go to where the people live. And every one of these Latino and Hispanic organizations are slightly different. I spent Little Haiti's a lot different than what's going on in Mexico.
Now, that being said, you also have Puerto Ricans, Cuban Americans that live in the I-4 corridor, in Orlando, in places like Tampa, Pinellas, the entire I-4 corridor there.
Where both of these guys were yesterday.
Exactly. So why would Latinos not break for Joe Biden? There's one theory that's been reported on before, and it's all you have to do is look 2 years back.
We've just gotten results in now from the state of Florida, big governor's race in the state of Florida.
And you look at the governor's race there. Governor Ron DeSantis was running against Andrew Gillum, who was then the mayor of Tallahassee.
You know, we didn't win it tonight. We didn't win this transaction.
Now, Gillum lost that race. And remember, this is during the blue wave midterms. Both Rick Scott wins his Republican Senate seat and Governor DeSantis wins.
We knew that Andrew Gillum talked about universal health care. He talked about fighting to save pre-existing conditions.
Credit the Republicans with tying Gillum to Bernie Sanders and to the socialist progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And that's the exact same playbook Republicans are using 4 years later.
This election is a choice between the American dream and a socialist nightmare. That's what it is. It's socialism. Venezuela, I used to say Venezuela on steroids. This would be, if they got in, a very, very, very large version of Venezuela. And it can happen with the Green New Deal and all these crazy, you know, look.
Now, to Venezuelan immigrants, and more importantly, to Cuban immigrants, that is a term that they don't like to hear because they fled their countries because of socialism.
If, in fact, he, Donald Trump, had been president when they were coming back in the old days, they wouldn't be here. Because look what he's doing. He's sending Cuban Americans back to the dictatorship. He's sending Venezuelan Americans back to the dictatorship.
And so even though younger Cuban Americans have skewed more towards Democrats, those older Cuban Americans, those new Venezuelan American refugees from Venezuela, they don't like the term socialist. And if they think that Joe Biden is going to sort of kowtow to the socialist wing of his party, that's going to be concerning to them.
I heard the promises of Fidel Castro, and I can never forget all those who grew up around me, who looked like me, who suffered and starved and died because they believe those empty promises.
But Brad, it's a voting block he needs not only in Florida, he needs it actually in places like Georgia, in Texas, Arizona, and Nevada.
I was going to say, when you look around and you're looking at the map on election night, like you're going to be the guy poking at different counties. When you look at the states these campaigns are visiting or where they're throwing around their money, where they're polling, is there a rhyme or reason to how these candidates see Tuesday night playing out? Anything stick out to you?
Yeah, I think they do. Look, one of the stories that wasn't really told was there's a reason why Democrats are looking at Texas, Georgia, and Arizona, states that have traditionally gone for Republican candidates. It's for three really main reasons.
Arizona State Public Affairs Professor Dr. Tom Riley says independents have turned this formerly bright red state purple and could help push it blue this time around. As a third of the state's electorate, independents are trending towards Biden by a whopping 25 points in the latest New York Times Siena poll.
One, Donald Trump actually underperformed compared to Mitt Romney in 2012 in all three of those states. That's really a story that hasn't been reported. Two, they saw some serious gains during the midterm elections, right? You have Kyrsten Sinema winning a Senate seat in Arizona, and you have Stacey Abrams nearly winning the governor's mansion in that very tightly contested race. She lost by a point and a half.
Prior to 2018, we were 50th in the country in voter turnout. Today, we are number one in the nation.
And then in Texas, you have Beto O'Rourke, who did lose to Ted Cruz, but we were talking about Texas, and he only lost by 3 points. And you also have, and the other main reason, demographics are changing. You have people moving to all three states, right? Including Latinos, but you have tax exiles from California, New York moving to Texas and Arizona. You have Latinos moving into Georgia. The Atlanta metro region is growing because there are jobs there.
It's not just people having babies. Like, people are literally moving to these states.
Yeah, they're completely, the demographics in these states are completely changing from what they were a decade ago. And then in Arizona and Georgia, you have Senate races that many believe are going to help Joe Biden.
Like, Sally's also behind in fundraising, and now she's telling her supporters that they could come up with more campaign cash to donate if they just fast a meal.
You have Mark Kelly, who seems to be leading in Arizona in that race against Martha McSally. And you have two Senate races in Georgia right now where Democrats are running very competitively. And so they think those down ballot races could bring more Democrats to the polls. Some people believe the same thing could happen in Texas as well when it comes to like some of the House races across the state.
It makes you think that if Joe Biden can flip any of those states, then it could be ballgame. But again, President Trump pulled out a lot of tight victories 4 years ago. We'll see if he does it again. Tom Yamas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yesterday, the CDC shed light on just how quickly COVID-19 can spread if left unchecked. It offered this case in Wisconsin, where teenage boys gathered for a summer school retreat. You had to provide a negative test from recent months and then self-quarantine for 7 days before the retreat instead of the recommended 14. But once everyone arrived, kids did not wear masks. They bunked in dorm rooms. People figured, you tested negative, you must be okay. Well, from one boy, the CDC estimates more than 100 people at this retreat contracted COVID and then returned to their home states all across the country. And this retreat, this world in which COVID was just not assumed to exist, in which organizers say, hey, we've got to open up, we'll take some precautions, but we can't stay closed forever, that retreat began in early July, which is also when the last economic quarter began. Yesterday, we found out just how much business America did that quarter. The numbers were great. But are there still trade-offs to be made? Let's bring in ABC's chief business and economics correspondent, Rebecca Jarvis. Rebecca, how good was this economic growth?
Brad, it was the best economic growth we've seen in a quarter ever in history. And that followed on the second quarter, which was the worst economic growth we've seen in a quarter in history.
The transition is going to be very interesting, but you're going to see some very good numbers coming out of the third quarter. It's a transition.
We had this situation where the economy ground to a halt in March and April. The government put trillions of dollars of stimulus into the economy.
In effect, this is a wartime level of investment into our nation.
And as things began to reopen over the summer months and into the fall, you saw rehiring take shape. You saw people spending money.
A new report shows the economy grew at a record 33.1% in the third quarter as the country began recovering from the even steeper losses triggered by the COVID-19 shutdown.
Talk about 33.1%, the greatest in history. Now, look, if I do, I mean, how many times can I say it? I'll say it five or six times during the speech. 33.1.
Now, when you think about how much the fall was versus what the recovery has looked like, economists say that we're basically about two-thirds of the way back, purely on a GDP basis.
Like, so when we heard this might not be a V-shaped recovery, it could look like a check mark or something like that. We're like almost back up there. What would it take to get where economists want it to be?
Well, this is why so many, including the Fed chair, have been pounding the table saying the government, the Washington needs to do another round of stimulus.
Even if policy actions ultimately prove to be greater than needed, they will not go to waste. The recovery will be stronger and move faster if monetary policy and fiscal policy continue to work side by side to provide support to the economy until it is clearly out of the woods.
There were still 22.7 million Americans who are claiming some type of unemployment benefits. The additional benefits under the CARES Act ran out at the end of July.
I went from working 70 hours to nothing.
There are no jobs to go back to right now, regardless of if people want to go back to work.
Last week, 751,000 Americans filed new claims for unemployment benefits. That's basically a number that resembles or is a proxy for layoffs. 751,000 Americans lost their job essentially last week. We would need to see more people return to work, a lot more people return to work, and far fewer people losing their jobs for a full recovery. And most economists believe that without an additional round of stimulus, and really the clock is ticking here, a lot of the recovery is in jeopardy.
And it's really uncertain because the number of cases of the virus are growing in the U.S. They are certainly growing in Europe. And that really does affect how we all feel about spending. And then, of course, it affects industries. So
it's not a foregone conclusion that the economy just goes up from here. In fact, it's possible that if things start to stall out, that we take a turn for the worse again.
Yeah, and like you said, it could all change as well if the virus gets out of control over the fall and winter as well. Rebecca Jarvis, thanks so much for the insight.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, a terror attack in Paris was as grisly as it gets, until an even deadlier one yesterday. What's happening in France after the break? We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there should be no compromise. Don't go back to that one doctor, you know the type, like I've had this person before, that doesn't actually listen to you or who seems just in a rush to end your appointment that you spent months making. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. You can search by location, availability, and insurance. So no compromises here, because with ZocDoc, you got more options than you know. We're talking about booking appointments with tens of thousands of top-rated, patient-reviewed, credible doctors and specialists. Go to ZocDoc.com/start here and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc, ZocDoc.com/start here. ZocDoc.com/start here. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It was a shock that was felt across France in mid-October when a school teacher was murdered in an apparent terror attack.
Turned out of that horrific terror attack outside Paris, a teacher decapitated on the street right in front of his school.
The hope was this was a one-off event, an example that nobody else would follow. Well, yesterday, there was another, this time with a higher death toll. And locals are worried that we might be seeing history repeat itself again in multiple ways. ABC's Maggie Rulli is in the Mediterranean coastal city of Nice, and Maggie, this is now what being classified as a terror attack.
Yeah, Brad, exactly. The French president came out calling this an Islamic terror attack, really doubling down on that point. And Brad, what is so scary and so sad is just the methods that we're seeing. This really seems to have followed a lot of the same things that happened in that other attack.
Well, we begin with breaking news this morning of a deadly terror attack in the southern France city of Nice.
This attack happened in Nice, like you said. It's supposed to be a beautiful coastal city. The basilica where it happened inside a church is absolutely gorgeous. And to know the gruesome attack that happened here is just heartbreaking.
It was at the Notre Dame Basilica where people were praying at the time. The attacker entered the church and stabbed a number of people, killing three.
And what we know so far, police gave a presser and they announced that, you know, the man who was the attacker is 21 years old from Tunisia. He had recently came into France. They believe that he attacked people inside this church. He stabbed three people. He killed a man, he killed a woman. He also nearly beheaded a woman. Police did show up to the scene. They tried to get the man to drop the knife. They ended up shooting as well. And Brad, this is really just the latest in a series of attacks. It has jolted this country. People are scared right now. They're nervous.
Well, I guess I'm trying to figure out sort of where this starts and how quickly it escalates. Because you look a couple weeks back, you had this murder. Well, back in September, you had the reemergence of that Charlie Hebdo cartoon that depicted the Prophet Muhammad. There was a terrorism trial that was happening. They republished the cartoon.
to that murder in mid-October. I mean, are authorities worried that that lit a fuse of some sort?
I think it drove home the point. But Brad, you know, this is something that France has been dealing with really for years. You mentioned that recent trial against Charlie Hebdo. It just seemed to reignite things here in the country. The trial started. We had one attack against people standing outside of Charlie Hebdo's former offices in September. We then had the French president, Emmanuel Macron, coming out, sort of introducing a new legal standard where he wanted to surveil mosques more tightly.
We're going to start with the war of words between the French and Turkish presidents over France's crackdown on radical Islam.
Sorry, France's right-wing paper Le Figaro having the strongest reaction to this today. On their front page, they accuse Erdogan of mobilizing Islamists against France.
Then it was just about a week later, we had that horrible attack on the history teacher. People in France really rallied together. You know, they came out, they supported each other when it came to freedom of expression, a core French value. At the same time, though, Brad... Across the Muslim world, we saw countries that were out protesting.
Son zamanlarda, Fransa'nın...
The person in charge of France has lost his way recently.
Many countries called for a boycott of French products. There's some pretty dramatic photos of supermarkets throughout the Muslim world where they actually, you know, saran wrapped up French products, took them off the shelves. This was something that people took very seriously. And it seemed to just ignite something that's already been in this country for years.
Well, and so, you know, there's terror that's directed by governments, but then there's more often, much more often, terror that's committed by, you know, disturbed individuals, extremist individuals. But is there a concern that, like, the words of Macron when he's defending these cartoons, when he's speaking out against Islamist terror, as he calls it, that he's escalating things?
Yeah, it's a complicated question, Brad. And I think for so many people, it's so polarizing. One critique that I think is important to pay attention to is how many politicians, and some accuse Macron of this, some accuse politicians in the Muslim world of this, but turning this into a political issue. France has an election coming up here in 2022, and many are saying, you know, is this just something that he's trying to talk to his base about it and get support for? Mm-hmm. Similarly, in other other countries that are using this, saying, boycott French products. Is this just something they're doing to rouse their base? And France is taking it really seriously. Macron came out. He said right now, France is pretty much at war. They are preparing for the worst. They went to the highest terror alert level, and they deployed 4,000 troops throughout the country, Brad. That's in addition to 3,000. So right now, there are 7,000 troops across France that are protecting places like schools and places of worship. I mean, we hear that phrase, a country on edge, quite a bit. It's become a cliche, but right now, that is what it feels like here in France.
Yeah, just an escalation in military presence there on the streets. All right, Maggie Rulli in Nice. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Do you think women are better suited to try to look past some of this partisanship and to work a little bit harder and better at overcoming that?
You know, women get things done. So I think we have had a very productive conversation here.
And one last thing. It's easy to get all tunnel visioned about the presidential race, but one of the things we do know will happen on Election Day is a record number of women will be on the ballot.
So we wondered how women of color are faring out there. I mean, the idea that out of about 300 women who are running for Congress, 115 of them, unprecedented, are women of color.
This year, ABC's Deborah Roberts has been meeting women of color who decided to run for office for the first time this year.
Hi, my name is Kim Klasick. I'm running for Congressional District Number 7 in Maryland, and I'm a Republican.
My name is Georgia Gomez. I'm the council president for the city of San Diego. I'm a proud Democrat running for the California 53rd District.
And recently, she put eight of them together in a roundtable.
What was interesting is when we started to talk national politics with these women, if we talked about the presidential election, things got a little tense.
So I would say, look at his actions. You know, of course, you know, not everybody loves his language. I think he likes to get a rise out of people. It keeps him, you know, in the headlines, which he needs to do as he's running for president for re-election. But for me, you know, look at his actions.
Can I respond to
go
that?
Go ahead. Go ahead, Georgia.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I mean, if we're going to be talking about whether being, if Trump is or the Republican Party is racist or not, it is true. We gotta look at actions.
And yet, she says, at some points, you could feel that tension dissolve when they talked about the challenges they had faced in their own ways.
Desiree Timms, who is from a district in the Illinois area, talked about her. She comes from grandparents who were sharecroppers.
My grandfather migrated to Southwest Ohio from the Jim Crow Deep South to work in the steel mills. And because of his ability to get that union job, he was able to climb his way to the middle class.
I mean, the idea that she's from West Dayton and this little black girl, as she said, is actually getting out there and trying to get it done. They were very proud of the fact that they're women of color.
And in many cases, you know, having my sisters here showing up in a party that I do not support is progress. And it sounds bizarre, but I tell people you can't expect people to be responsible for you if you don't hold them accountable.
But they also felt that they are better situated to be able to reach across the aisle because they're used to navigating different differences and difficulties in life.
And that's what will make a stronger democracy, is reaching across the aisle, talking to your sister, making things work for your community. This is about public service. And so as long as we get more women in politics and in Congress and elected to local governments and state governments, we will see a stronger, healthier democracy.
And so from Baltimore to California, Deborah says, you get the keen sense that even in this unbelievably divided environment, when you look a bit further down the ballot, there's still people out there just trying their best to represent their communities and lift each other up. Really cool project from Deborah and her team. Just 4 days to Election Day. What could go wrong, guys? It's just a full moon tomorrow. Halloween's here. Our clocks are changing on Sunday. Good luck with that. Start Here is produced by David Rhine, Kelly Therese, Josh Cohan, Trevor Hastings, Ariel Chester, Tara Gimble, and Lauren Efron. Thanks to Eric Johnson, Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, Abe Velez, and Stacia Deshishku. Special thanks this week to Vanessa Diaz, Ben Newman, Cameron Jones, Ryan Kessler, Kinga Janik, Katie Dendas, Chris Berry, Ibtisin Gwenfo, Julia Horowitz, and Mary Alice Parks. I'm Brad Milkey. We got a special bonus episode coming your way Sunday, so I'll see you then.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.